TED Audio Collective.
You know, for the record, Colleen, I don't think you hate me.
I don't hate you.
And I also don't think you hated me 4 years ago when you wrote that tweet. I don't think you knew me.
Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools.
I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com. Designed for work.
Hey, and welcome back to Conversations with People Who Hate Me, the show where I take negative online comments and use them as a starting point for offline conversations. I'm your host, Dylan Marin. Sometimes I speak to people who have said negative things to me online. Other times, like today, I moderate conversations between strangers. And it's a show where we humanize people on the internet. Like I say at the end of every episode, and I'm saying at the beginning of this one, it's just a reminder that there is a human on the other side of the screen. Today's episode deals with an interesting topic, which is hate directed at a celebrity. And sometimes this hate is kind of directed nowhere because there's no kind of guarantee that the celebrity is going to see it. So today, I'm moderating a call between Amanda Palmer and a woman named Colleen. Amanda Palmer, some of you may know, she is a musician, she's an author, she's a big deal. She has been around for a while and she has a lot of fans, and she also has, as we'll find today, some detractors too. And I'll be connecting her with Colleen, who 4 years ago to the day of recording this conversation, 4 years ago to the day, that's pretty wild, Colleen tweeted, "I'm not sure I hate any celebrity the way I hate Amanda Palmer." So first, I will speak one-on-one to Amanda, then I'll speak one-on-one to Colleen, and then, you guessed it, I will connect them to each other. This is a really fascinating episode. We get a lot of really cool introspection from both parties, and I hope you enjoy it. So here we go. Here is Amanda. Amanda, hi.
Hi.
You are so many things.
Oh, God.
You're a musician. You're an author. You are an artist, you are a creator, you're a digital creator. How do you identify?
I don't like to identify.
Great.
I actually feel like the harder I try to identify myself, and of course then you get attached to that narrative and that identification, the worse off I am. So I actually figure that my job is to just do the things, and then it's somebody else's job to say what they are.
And you, I love that a lot. So you, according to your, you know, online presence, you are a maker of things.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of my life wanting to identify and be identified as a songwriter and a musician. And I actually still feel that way. And sometimes I wonder if I get in my way by constantly talking about other things and doing all sorts of other things that distract people from the fact that what I fundamentally do, if I have one salient real talent, it's music. But what's funny is I find myself actually even disagreeing with that. Sometimes I look back at everything and I think that I only got into music so that I could do people. Because what I really love is other people, and I really love being with them, and I love talking to them, and I love figuring them out, and I love helping them, and I love when they help me, and I just fucking love people.
Yeah.
And music, you know, I look back at my childhood self and the way I viewed the world and what I saw, and it looked like the most exciting available job to be in the mix with other people was being a performer and a musician, because the whole narrative surrounding that is you're allowed to be emotional, you're supposed to connect, your job is to sort of be this tribal shaman of emotion and connection and heightened experience. And I just remember looking at that as a kid and being like, I want that job. If mm-hmm. that's a job, mm-hmm. like all these other jobs look boring. Mm-hmm. I want that job. I want the job where you're allowed to just be as real as possible with
yeah.
people.
Yeah. No, I love that. So you seem to have a very uniquely close and wonderful relationship with your fans. How did you start fostering that?
Well, I started with the Dresden Dolls. Mm-hmm. And when the Dresden Dolls started as a local band, playing in bars and lofts and, you know, teeny shows with not many people, and mm-hmm. we did a lot of that. Like mm-hmm. we were a small band for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I just took my cues from my mentors, mm-hmm. like the bands that I was really, really into and loved as a teenager, and their approach, because these were like alternative punk folk bands, like their approach was very human. Mm. They were really connected. The bands that I loved stayed after shows and signed and talked to people and crashed at fans' houses. And that, you know, I came out of DIY world. Mm-hmm. And from my way of looking at it, that's why you do the job. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to be a musician because you want to hang out with people and you want to have a lot of friends and stay in their houses and eat their food and be in the scene. So the Dresden Dolls were a very community-based band. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until we sort of got up the ladder a little bit and we were touring more and I encountered other bands and just saw more of the world that I actually understood that what we were doing wasn't always the average.
Yeah.
In certain scenes it was, in the punk scene and, you know, the certain folk scenes. But I remember being really, like, astounded and then feeling really naive when I realized that there were a lot of bands who didn't want to talk to their fans,
yeah.
didn't want to hang out after shows, didn't want to read fan mail, mm-hmm. didn't want to be known, mm-hmm. didn't want to be touched, like, really loved their jobs, loved the music they created, but really, you know, the way I did really confused them.
Yeah.
And then I actually had a real turning point around 2010-12 when, like, the dark internet erupted mm-hmm. and hate really started mm-hmm. coming my way. Because I encountered my first bit of internet hate mm-hmm. locally, like at the local level. In Boston, there was a music magazine called The Noise, and it was the Boston black and white, you know, available at all record shops. And they had their own forum, their own board called the Noise Board. And this was pre-social media. And the Noise Board is where all of the snarky local musicians went to dish and rag mm-hmm. on other musicians. And it was really toxic. And it was the first time I encountered that level of negativity and, like, blatant hatred of me. Mm. Like, it almost felt like there was a competition for a while on the Noise Board to see who could say more terrible things about the Dresden Dolls and how bad we were.
And it was aimed at you.
It was all aimed at me. Actually, that was something that was a little bit of a theme around that time, which is all the hatred was aimed at me. And Brian got occasional sympathy, Brian the drummer of the Dresden mm-hmm. Dolls, for having to be in the poor dude in the band with the talentless, hairy cunt who can't sing.
Wow.
That was Brian's lot. Is like that poor guy.
Whoa. Well, this is a good transition to what we're even here to do, which is that, of course, with the proliferation of the internet and the ability to really voice whatever it is you think about a public person, I think the flip side of being a public person who a lot of people really love is you also get to find the people who don't feel that way about you. Do you pay attention to that? Do you pay attention to the negativity?
Yeah, I do, but I've also learned how to dance with it. Mm. It's part and parcel of being in the arena of the internet. You're not allowed to just go into the internet and collect the goodies and the candy and the wonderful things that shower you with wonderful ego feelings.
Yeah.
If you're going to go out and get those goods, you're going to have to also dance through and around the slings and arrows that mm-hmm. are going to head your way. And then it's really just a question of, you know, at what volume do you want mm-hmm. The cost benefit of love and hate in your life?
Yeah. So a person on the internet named Colleen tweeted, "I'm not sure I hate any celebrity the way I hate Amanda Palmer."
Oh, Colleen.
Yeah. So what does it feel?
I already love her.
You love Colleen. So what does it feel like to read something like that?
I mean, I think in terms of the spectrum of internet hate, that's not very yeah. bad. It just feels really general. I don't know. It always makes me so curious. Like, I've weathered so many storms of hatred on the internet that I'm always very curious about what's driving the hatred, what's driving the person.
Yeah. This is a kind of impossible question because this is just a thing that is written on Twitter. Do you have any perception of Colleen at the moment?
Just from that tweet?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you something. Usually when I see comments like that, I read the rest of the person's feed.
Oh, yeah.
To see if they're just a general professional hater or if I'm a special unicorn in their world and they love everything else, but they just happen to have reserved some hatred for me. No, I don't have any perception of her. I mean, my main MO when I'm dealing with hatred like this on the internet is I almost never engage. And lately, if I do engage, I literally try to disarm the person with love and understanding.
Yeah.
And I confuse the shit out of them because no one's ever expecting that.
Yeah. Hey, Colleen.
Hey, Dylan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am good. You've had a good weekend?
I did. How about you?
Yeah, good. Yeah, I kind of spent the afternoon at the gym just so that I've been so busy this week, which is
not
why I couldn't
to
talk
brag.
Till now.
Check you out. No, I'm proud of you.
Thank you so much.
So, Colleen, to kick us off, let's start small. Let's start mundane. How's your day going so far?
My day's been good. It's been really relaxed. Had some Ethiopian food and went to the gym, did some ironing.
Great. Oh my God. Ironing and gym. You're living the life. So.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. So in only the briefest way, think social media profile. How would you describe yourself? Tell me about Colleen.
I am very honest. I'm very candid. What you see is what you get.
Great.
I try to be as honest online as I would be in person with someone.
Great.
So I try my best to be authentic, and I'm pretty weird, but I am what I am.
Okay, perfect. So the topic, and also ironically person, we are here to talk about is Amanda Palmer. So this brings us to the tweet that you wrote. And a few years ago, you wrote a tweet that said, "I'm not sure I hate any celebrity the way I hate Amanda Palmer." So how does it feel to hear that tweet read back to you now?
Honestly, it feels, I don't know. Part of it, I think hate might be a strong word because I don't actually know her.
Mm-hmm.
But I know where I was when I wrote that tweet. Mm-hmm. And I stand by the feelings I had at that time.
Mm-hmm. You stand by the feelings moment. You had. Okay, well, no, and that's totally great. What I want to know currently, right now, in this moment, you haven't spoken to Amanda yet. What is your perception of Amanda?
Oh, boy.
Go for it.
My perception is not great. Mm-hmm. It's one of outlandishness for the sake of, I guess you could say, just to get a reaction from people. Brass, she rubs me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how else to explain it other than she rubs me the wrong way and she makes me cringe with a lot of the things that I read her having done or having said. Oh, it's off-putting, I think, is the best way to put it.
Off-putting. So we have your perceptions about Amanda. We have the fact that you have stood by this tweet. What I want to know is, how are you feeling now that you're about to speak to her?
Honestly, there's a little bit of shame. I'm going to be totally just honest with you.
Shame for writing
it's not,
it?
Yeah. Shame, a little shame for that because I don't think I ever thought she would know that I tweeted that, you know, and it's not something I think I'm a better person than I am then in that that was one of those tweets that I might not have said to someone's face at the time. So there's a little bit of shame in knowing that I said something that could potentially hurt someone and hurt her feelings. I don't think she cares at all about me or what I think of her, but yeah, I feel a little, little shame. So I'm a little nervous to talk to her because it's potentially someone whose feelings I've hurt that makes me feel a little weird. So,
right. And it sounds like from just speaking to you on the phone, it sounds like this is not the type of thing that you would necessarily, you maybe say to anyone in your life, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly it. And there probably was a time and place when I was a lot younger where I would have said, oh, I don't care. This is how I feel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm just going to tell you.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Right. We're all evolving humans and God bless us for that, you know?
Yeah. I evolved into that impulse control. That part of my brain grew and now I probably wouldn't say it.
Listen, I support you.
Oh gosh, it's just now dawned on me that she's probably going to ask me things.
Oh boy. No. I don't obsess over that too much. It's going to be, again, you only have to answer whatever you feel comfortable answering.
Yeah.
All I ask is that you just come in as your wonderful self and we just be three humans on the phone together.
Awesome.
Cool.
I'm excited about it. More than I am nerves, it's excitement.
Hey, Colleen, you're on the line and you are on the line with Amanda.
Hi, Colleen.
Oh, hi, Amanda.
We're all here together in this beautiful digital space right now that we have carved out. Amanda, let's start with you. I would love for you to tell Colleen who you are. What makes you you?
Well, I don't know how much Colleen already knows about me. She must know a little bit if she made a comment on the internet, but I am, you know, I'm a musician on the road and a writer and a confused mom because I never expected to have a kid and spent 10 years struggling trying to figure out whether or not to have a kid and finally did it. I'm a like searching creative person trying to figure out what to do. That's what I feel like right now.
That's great. Colleen, take it away. Tell us about you. What makes you you?
All right. So I, honestly, a Jane of many trades over here. Mm-hmm. I am creative as well, and I can relate to Amanda in that sense. I used to be a wedding photographer, and I was also a baker for a really long time. So wedding cakes, things of that nature. And now I work a big girl job in sales, so not anything I ever thought that I would do, but here we are, and I actually really love it, and I'm just a person who, I don't know, I like to challenge myself. I like to, the reason I took this call was I like to talk to people who are different from me and kind of put myself in uncomfortable situations to grow, and just, I'm a curious person. I love learning about things. I like, I don't know, just kind of watching the world unfold and getting to be a part of it is really cool and terrifying and exciting.
Yeah. You sound amazing.
Yeah.
Where are you? You're in Texas?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. So I'm in Texas. I'm in Austin, Texas, and I work for a tech company here downtown.
I like Austin. I've done South by Southwest a lot of times, and I'm actually just about to do it again. In March, I'm going to be in...
Oh, that's exciting.
Same town.
Oh, that's awesome.
Same town. So if we wind up really liking each other,
yeah,
I'll invite you to my show.
Yeah,
I'll invite you to my show anyway.
I was thinking about that. I thought, what if this goes so well that I actually completely reverse my opinion here?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, she's really wonderful. And now she's my best friend. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah, that's we're all going to leave here best friends holding hands and running off into the sunset together.
On a unicorn.
On a unicorn.
Perfect.
Three unicorns or one unicorn?
No, all on one unicorn.
Okay,
So Colleen,
you're in the middle and we're clutching.
Yes. Okay. That sounds great. So Colleen, the unicorn will be arriving in Austin. I guess, what is unicorn time? What is unicorn fly time?
The unicorn should come to New York, pick us up, and then we'll ride to Austin on the unicorn.
And then
we'll all go to California, of course.
Yeah. Okay, great. So Colleen, does that work for you?
Oh,
unicorn,
yes,
picking
beaches.
You up. Okay.
Perfect.
Great.
I'm on board.
Okay. Cool. We'll see you sometime in a few hours, I think, is how fast unicorns travel. Okay, so this is great. You guys know each other a little. I mean, as you know, what we are here to do is we're here to talk about a tweet. I'm sharing this with love. So, Colleen, 4 years ago to the day, you wrote, "I'm not sure I hate any celebrity the way I hate Amanda Palmer." Rather than what you feel about that comment now, I would just like to hear what inspired that comment.
Okay, so even just hearing that out loud makes my stomach just churn. So what prompted that, it was a combination of things where I have friends who were big Dresden Doll fans, and I tried to listen to them a couple times, but it just wasn't for me. It seemed kind of over the top and the sense of force. I don't know how to, like it was showmanship, but it was forced shock value is kind of how I perceived it. And so I didn't really, you know, I kind of left it alone and didn't listen to much of the music. And then Amanda kept popping up kind of all over the place in interviews she was doing or events that she had done. And it was like one thing after another where I would hear something or see something and be like, what? I don't get this. And so then I ended up working an event where she was present, and it was an event for her, one of her books. And the fan base, dealing with the fan base before and after, was one of the most off-putting fan bases I've dealt with. And it was weird because I have friends who are big fans of hers, but they didn't act like this. And so it was just, I was so stressed. I was tired. I'd worked this event for like 12 hours and then dealing with all of this and reading all of these things and hearing all this stuff. And I was just like, I can't. Mm-hmm. That's what prompted that tweet.
What was it about my fans that was off-putting?
Yeah. So it was this, they were very evangelical. Honestly, it was like, you are their God. Mm-hmm. And you can do no wrong. And it was a little scary, honestly, the way that people viewed you and talked about you and were losing their minds just to meet you. Mm. And I just kept thinking, she's just a person, you know, she's an artist, you like her art, but she's no better than you. And there were some other things. There were a couple things, like some of them had brought instruments with them and were playing them in the bookstore while the event was going on, and we had to keep, you know, whatever, it happens. We talked to them and were, you know, said like, you can't do this in a bookstore. And they would just be like, why? And a couple of us dealt with it to the point where we were like, I don't know what else to do. So this sense of just like worshiping you really made me uncomfortable. And I don't want to discredit you as a person at all or anything that you do. But it was that sense of just, you were their religion.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, if it makes you feel any better, that, like, seeing that kind of behavior from any human being can be really off-putting, period. And I mean, I don't like that when I have to deal with it.
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, Colleen, to be fair, I think there's a sense of like internal contrarianism that we all have. Like, if we see people worshiping someone who we don't particularly know well, you know, there's a sense of like, oh, well, I can identify myself as not that. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And there's, there's almost not necessarily a power, but yeah, you're identifying yourself by identifying yourself as not that.
Right.
Okay. So that's interesting. Okay. So Amanda, I want to hear from you. What does it feel like to receive a tweet like this?
Well, in context, if it was the only tweet I'd ever received like that, it would have been a lot more crushing. I see so much stuff like that that it doesn't, I think there's such an immense amount of it out there that hearing it once doesn't really, the first few times I read things like that on the internet, it was really devastating. But I also wonder, like, you know, especially having had some time to reflect and some perspective on being, you know, the target of tweets like that, I always wonder who the audience is.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, I guess that's what I would ask Colleen is, like, who, you know, it probably wasn't written for me to see, because most people who write things like that assume that I'm not going to see them.
And but, Colleen, you didn't tag Amanda in it, right? You just, I mean, you didn't tag Amanda. It was just putting it out into the ether.
Yeah. So I always wonder, like, when someone sits down at a computer and says, I know what I'm going to write that and press return, who's the audience? Like, if the audience isn't me, is it, you know, is it this person's friends? Is it their community? Like, why does this person need to say this for who? What's the intended effect? And
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of like the curiosity that comes up in my head when I read something like that nowadays.
So Colleen, who were you thinking of for this tweet? Who was the audience?
The audience was the ether, honestly. Mm-hmm. It was it was a thought that I had and wanted to get it out. I don't think I had an idea of why I was posting it or who I wanted to read it. It was one of those where I could not stop thinking about it that night, about how frustrated I was, and I threw it out there for it to exist on the internet, whatever they do out there in the internet bubble.
Do you think you would have still written it if you could have imagined me on the other side of the computer reading it the next day?
Stay right there. We'll be right back. If you like this podcast and you want to help support it directly, you can check out our merch store. We have brand new shirts that say, empathy is not endorsement, a mantra I've made for the show, and stickers that say what I say at the end of every episode, remember there's a human on the other side of the screen. Also, there's a shirt that has Rob Wilson's beautiful logo for our show on it. Check it all out at www.conversationswithpeoplewhohateme.com and click on merch. All right, let's get back to the conversation.
Do you think you would have still written it if you could have imagined me on the other side of the computer reading it the next day?
No, honestly, like, I kind of want to cry right now because I'm telling somebody who's also just a human being, here's this horrible thing I said about you. Like, hate is a really strong word. And for me to say it about someone who could come across it, I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know why I thought that was acceptable. But I was younger then, but I never thought that you would see it. And if I had known you would see it, it never, never would have gone out there. Like, and that is a huge lack of foresight on my part because it's the internet. You can search your name. You can find what the whole internet has to say about you. And a lot of it is really unpleasant. And I just added to it, you know, and you're a human being like me. And to put myself in those shoes and to say, what if somebody wrote this about me? I would have just cried. Like I would have.
You know, for the record, Colleen, I don't think you hate me.
Yeah.
I don't even think you hate
me. I don't hate you.
And I also don't think you hated me 4 years ago when you wrote that tweet. I don't think you knew me.
Yeah.
No. You know?
But I think about that experience that you had and the frustration and also having to do a really, really long, laborious job under the umbrella of Amanda Palmer and having nowhere to take that.
Mm.
That's sort of what I imagine happening.
Yeah. I also wanted
It was a lot of misplaced blame. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm furious that you cut me off. I just wanted to be clear. This is not a shame podcast, right? Like the goal of this project is not to shame you for writing. You said you were about to cry. I mean, I encourage you to feel all the feelings.
Feel bad.
No, I totally get that. I just I just want to be clear, you're not the only human to have ever logged on to Twitter.com and said something negative about a celebrity, right? Like, I hate to break it to you, you did not copyright that, and you don't own that copyright.
Gosh,
and
dang it.
No, I know, but I just want to say, like, I mean, this is why I like making this show, and this is why I like connecting people, because of conversations like this. But to be fair, you were just using the mechanisms put in place for you as they were intended to be used, right? You are constantly asked, you are constantly prompted, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? Share it in this box, put it out into the ether. Maybe someone will respond to it, kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? And so I don't want you to be falling on the sword too hard, because it's not like... I think what I'm interested in exploring here is just how innocuous hate on the internet is, quote unquote hate, and just getting to the bottom of why someone said it. So
can I add something?
Please.
Okay. So I've been thinking about this, and as you're mentioning the shame element here and, you know, not wanting to fall on the sword, et cetera, I do have questions for Amanda that I do want to ask.
Yes, please.
So some things that I'm really curious about that have kind of triggered, not just that event was not the primary reason, you know, there were a lot of culminating mm-hmm. elements here mm-hmm. That kind of added up to it. And I stand by my frustration and sometimes disgust with some of the things that I've read and seen. And I know that that does not make up the whole person. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation. There are some things that I've seen and been
that.
Like, what?
Yeah. I would love that, because okay. yeah. I'd love to answer any questions yeah. that you have. So hit me.
So go for it.
Okay. So there was a time where I came across this video, of you, were at a show, Amanda, and you were talking about how, and I'm going to use some words here that I think could be triggering to some of your audience. So I just...
Mm-hmm. Colleen is right. This next section deals with suicide, drug use, and death. And if those are three things, or any one of those things, are not something that you should be listening to right now, or something you just don't want to hear, skip ahead approximately 7 minutes and 6 seconds, and you will skip this entire part.
You had talked about how you had faked your own suicide in an attempt to convince your partner to stop doing drugs. And you filmed it, you then use the audio in your music. And that, when I watched that little video, I sat there dumbfounded. I was like, what? Mm. So I wanted to ask you, is that situation, was that real? Is that a thing that actually happened? Just if you could help me understand that situation, because that is something that I do look at and wonder, what?
Yeah, I was a freshman in college. I was 17. And my boyfriend at the time was not using heroin, but had been. And it was a condition of our relationship that he not use again. Mm-hmm. And so one night... he actually, you know, and it was an agreement in our relationship that I didn't care what he did as long as he was honest with me. Mm. All I asked is that he not lie. I was like, I can handle anything. So if you're going to go back and you're going to use, if it's going to happen, at least come talk to me, but don't let me find out by accident. Don't let me, whatever. Mm. So he came to me one night and he told me, I promised I would tell you, and I just have every intention of going out and doing this. And it was... very frightening and really, you know, kind of heartbreaking, because I was like, oh, wow, here you are considering me mm-hmm. and telling me the truth, but what you're telling me is really terrible. Mm-hmm. And I don't even, and I was seven, yeah. I was 17. Like, yeah. You have to understand, I just didn't come from a background where I had any junkie friends or I knew what any of it meant. I was so lost. And
right.
All I knew is the degree to which it was bad and dangerous. Mm. And I mean, this is coming from a teenager who did a lot of drugs, but I didn't do a lot of hard drugs or really any hard drugs until I was older. And even then, this was just like, I was out of my wheelhouse. And I was so angry at him, and I didn't know how to express it, and I didn't know what to do. And he had also told me, I'm going to come home to your dorm at the end of the night. And I was like, I don't even know what this means. I don't even know what's going to happen. I don't even know what these drugs do to him. I just don't know anything. And, you know, I was like an over-dramatic performance art theatrical weirdo in my freshman year of college. And I don't look back at this with any kind of like braggy pride, but I definitely look back at that 17-year-old and I'm like, man, what a shitty situation. And so I like got some fake blood and chocolate syrup and like poured it all over my bed, and I lay there and like in a pool of blood in my freshman dorm room bed and was like, I'm just going to wait here until he comes back. This is my way of expressing I'm really angry and confused and I don't know what to do. And I also, I didn't film it or video it, but I did have, I was an experimental music major. I taped everything in my life at the time. So I left a tape recorder running in my room. And he came in at like, you know, I lay there for like an hour flipping the tape over again and again and again, or 2 hours. It seemed endless. And he finally came back and he was scared shitless for a second. And then, you know, and I let him be scared shitless for like 20 seconds, which felt like an eternity. And then I laughed and I said, fooled you. You really, you've really scared the shit out of me and you've really disappointed me and I don't know what to do in my relationship right now. And he thought it was really sick and funny, but he also had a very black sense of humor. We both did. It was what attracted us to each other.
Right.
And I don't look back at that episode and think, aha, I was such a clever, you know, I was such a clever, groundbreaking artist at 17 that I did this amazing thing. I don't have any pride about that. I mean, I look back at it and it's a very... it's a pretty apt portrait of who I was at 17, which was like very over the top and pretty clumsy. And I didn't know enough about human relationships to stop him in that moment and say, you know, I'm glad you're stopping me right now to tell me that you're about to go off and do heroin, but actually, can we have a larger conversation about our relationship? I just wasn't grown up. I wasn't grown up enough at that point to know that that was on the table. I was a total neophyte in the communication and the relationship department. So that was my very off-color, weird way of dealing. He also died 6 months later.
Oh my God.
So, you know,
the fear
was like, it was well-founded.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't seem like a casual drug user who was, you know, just going off and like smoking weed. So I also look back at that episode through the lens of what happened immediately after. And, you know, and like, how many bizarre, stupid things do we do when we're 17? Because certainly if I heard, if I heard about someone doing that as a 42-year-old, I would really be shocked and appalled. But I also just think that there are things that we do when we're younger and we're teenagers and we're learning the language of emotions and we're learning the potential tools that we have to communicate with each other. And my tools at 17 were fucking zero. I didn't know how to be in a relationship when I was 17. I knew nothing.
Or how to confront drug abuse in a loved one.
Clueless.
Yeah.
All of those things.
Yeah.
Clueless.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I could totally understand, Colleen, like how you would see, you know, you would see me telling that story in an offhanded way. And, you know, I think if you saw me on stage at 42 telling that story to an audience, I don't think you would see a whole lot of cavalier, wasn't I cute humor in it. You know, the whole thing feels like a portrait of a dumb 17-year-old, you know. But also, I don't just look at that dumb 17-year-old and think, oh, I was such a dumb 17-year-old. I look at that 17-year-old with a lot of empathy and sympathy. Because I didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, that makes so much sense, honestly. And hearing hearing you tell the story from your perspective and like what happened and not hearing it, you know, on stage recorded live, it's a lot different. And especially knowing that you were 17, because I was 17 when I started college, and I did not have the wits about me to do something like that. And if all the things that I've ever done were publicized for the world, I don't even know what people would have to say about me. And to just kind of, I don't know, it's very human to hear you talk about it that way and to hear you say that you didn't know how else to cope with things, essentially. If I'm getting that right, is that it was that your coping skill was in this fashion for this situation, like there, you didn't know how else to handle it. I don't know. I can empathize a lot with you in that regard. And to be quite honest, I just want to give you a hug right now, hearing that,
Colleen,
hearing that whole situation and that story. I do. Like, I had Thank it you. Written down, like on my notes, like, what in the heck, why would you do this? No, I can see it now. I get it. It wasn't a performance piece for you. It wasn't something, because that's kind of how it came across, at least from my point of view, that it was this thing you were doing to add into your art.
Yeah, no.
When that does not seem to be the case.
I also think that's a weird thing that happens with celebrities, right? Which is like you're just getting one tiny, and I say you meaning all of us, and I'm for sure including me in this, Colleen, but we get like one tiny little slice into a person who is a public person, and then we hear about this one thing that happened when they were younger or a thing that happened a week ago, and we try and fit that into our own understanding of the world. Do you know what I mean? And
yeah.
So we're part of a system that is built to encourage our judgment of that person, whether it's positive or negative, and we're unable to then share it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, it's just interesting.
You know, and even I really have to stop myself a lot when it comes to, you know, making snap judgments or shaking my head in either direction, you know, like, and I just sort of look at it and I'm like, it's such an obvious mirror. And everyone who has feelings about any of it, including me, there's just so much that it says about me and what upsets me about me and what upsets me, you know, about my particular situation. And even after all I've been through, it's really hard for me to keep my own judgment of people in check, especially other women. And I just watch it all the time, the constant, you know, like the constant comparison and the constant, you know, where do I stand compared to where she stands and da 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 and all of that. It just feels like such an epidemic sickness, especially between women.
Colleen, this is a kind of impossible question to answer just because it's hard. But do you think there was an element to Amanda being a woman that kind of enabled you to maybe feel that distaste for her more strongly when you wrote this tweet?
I really hate that I'm going to say yes, because it's not something that I'm proud of, and it's not something that I was really conscious of. And I think part of that has to do with how painfully critical I am of myself. So I think it is a sense of projection, of, you know, if I'm going to be this critical and this harsh with how I deal with myself and think about what I've done, well, I don't want to give someone else a break. Like, you need to be held to the same standards that I hold myself to. But at the same time, I think there's a bias where I maybe oftentimes think women might be more capable at certain situations and in certain places than men are, and especially in places where men have had more power. I think I do feel like I have a bias and I have an unfair, it's not fair, essentially.
No, that's like really fascinating introspection, Colleen. Amanda, do you feel that you do that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've been on a introspective learning curve about my own sexism, especially in the last 5 or 10 years. And a lot of it is really, I mean, just like Colleen's just started her comment that she hates that the answer is yes. Some of it just makes me so ashamed when I really have to unpack and unearth some of my thoughts and some of my patterns. And, you know, and it's just, it's a vicious circle. And women are so awful to each other. And I really, I mean, if I look at the pie chart of hate that I've gotten on the internet, the vast majority of it has come from other women. But also, you know, when I look at who I, you know, and especially in the course of my early career, everything that really riled me, you know, the things that upset me, the things that pissed me off, the things that made me jealous, like the things that brought out my worst, least generous self, it was all my, like, my feelings of scarcity and gross competitiveness with other women. You know, I was way more upset and jealous of my female peers. You know, the, like, why does Fiona Apple get that when I don't? You know, why is, you know, why does Regina Spektor get to do this and I don't? Like, my peers, my friends. And, you know, and as, even as a teenager, like, I was really allergic to the women who later would become my mentors and heroes, like Ani DeFranco and Tori Amos. And I grew up in a competitive household with an older sister. And I think I just really, I really just had that, like, narrow-minded set of scarcity blinders on that celebrating and feeling a sense of abundance around and with other women was not fucking allowed. It was either me or her. And if she was succeeding, then I wasn't. And if I was succeeding, then she couldn't. And I feel like I was taught to think that way. And actually unpacking that in my 30s, it was, like, really enlightening. And, oh, my God, this is the way I think. But, oh, my God, my whole life has been so fucked. I've literally walked through my entire life with this really horrific set of sunglasses on. And, like, looking back, did I have any of those feelings about my male counterparts? And no, like, I just didn't. I just wasn't, I just wasn't jealous of Jack White. He was out there playing his guitar and doing a great job. Like, it, and figuring all of that out was just, it just made me feel so ashamed and so gross. But also sitting with it and going, okay, like, here's where you're starting. You're starting from here. This is the only way out, is to, like, pull up this carpet and see the creepy crawlies and, like, not put the carpet back down because they were fucked. And I still have to keep myself in check all the time, every day, when I see these thoughts bubbling into my head. You know, like I was saying with reading this Lena Dunham article yesterday, it was almost like a meditation practice. I was like, here you are reading this article. What are you feeling? But why? And stop and think about it. Don't just have these mindless thoughts.
No, I absolutely, that I can relate to that so much, in the sense when you mentioned scarcity, it dawned on me that that is a huge element of this, is that I think for a lot of things, especially with career women or women who are in fields that are pretty male dominant, at least for me, I've had this sense of, I want to be that woman. I want to be the first woman to do it, or the you know, to get the accolade of having the woman attached to whatever it was that I've accomplished, where it was like, you know, if other people are meeting metrics and are winning awards and things like that, oh, that's great. But to be the first woman who did this thing, or to be one of the very few women who have been able to do this, kind of created this sense of competition for me that I didn't realize I had until very recently. And I'm about to go into my 30s. And I think that's going to be a huge part of the next decade for me, is in the same way that Amanda said, is unpacking that, you know, and that probably is part of the reason that I don't look at other male artists who make me uncomfortable with whatever they're performing or whatever they're doing. I don't have this sense of, like, ugh, you know, yeah. like you. It's like, oh, you're just weird. Okay. Mm-hmm. But here's Amanda. And my reaction is completely different. It's like, oh, great. Okay. We have a few women in this music scene right here, the one that she's a part of. And that's how you're going to present yourself. Like, please don't do that to us when that's not what's happening at all.
Yeah, we just,
or it's happening in my head and it's happening in a lot of our heads rather than,
right,
you know, the reality.
Yeah, I think we see the people next to us, the people that we're grouped in with, boxed in with, we see them under a closer and almost more cruel and vicious microscope, a really unfair microscope, I think. And I honestly think that's just the system working, right? Like, I think other yeah. people benefit from marginalized groups feeling that there is few seats at the table and they have to fight each other to get those seats.
That's the oldest trick in the book.
Yeah.
And that's the old patriarchy trick is, you know, pit all of these women against each other because then they'll never be able to collaborate and get out of there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and it's frightening. It's frightening to realize that. And also, Neil and I actually have a term for it, and we use it a lot when we're talking about work and competition and how we feel about other artists. And I came up with it because of Tori Amos. I thought it was a good metaphor. We call it the piano string theory, mm-hmm. which is a piano that's really out of tune actually mm-hmm. doesn't sound as out of tune than a piano that's slightly out of tune. Mm-hmm. So two strings oh. that are almost resonating with each other, but not quite, are going to sound more dissonant. And I was like, that's the thing. It's not the people who are far off in different cultures, in different countries that you can't relate to. It's the woman who's standing right next to you at the same job, who is the same age, who is the same color, who, you know, has the slightly better situation, who you despise and who you yes. use as this basis of comparison. And that's, you know, that's also just our terrible culture feeding us this diet of competition and scarcity instead of mutual compassion and celebration. And, you know, if she's doing better, then that's better for me, and we will all benefit, and all beings will benefit, because we're really not fed that script. And, you know, and I've seen it so much in the music industry. And, you know, I also went through my own learning curve, like listening to Colleen talk about, like, the, you know, her reaction of listening to the tweet that she sent. I also had I had my own learning curve on the early internet, because I said, you know, I would say really negative things about people, just not thinking about it, you know, because this is how I talk with my friends, and I'm just going to talk shit about this artist, or I'm just going to complain about this situation. And I, you know, and after getting some blowback for that, and after realizing that I actually had a real voice and that my voice was real and there it was sitting in the world and it was going to actually have consequences or an audience, I sort of stopped and made a, you know, like made a commitment to myself to not add any negativity to the internet. I think especially also being on the receiving end of it, I was like, why would anyone want to be the receiving end of anything like this on the internet? So I feel like I've learned the same lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like we're all coming to terms with that too. Colleen, you said you had some other questions for Amanda. Are there any other questions you have?
Yeah, it kind of ties into what we're talking about right now. But it comes down to basically, Amanda, how do you think people as a whole perceive you? And honestly, how is it different from how you perceive yourself?
That's such a good question. It's such a complicated question, because it...
Yeah, it's a lot to unbox there.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't... You know, depending who you're talking about, I think there's a lot of people out there who perceive me a lot of different ways. I mean, on the one hand, you know, you've got one side of the spectrum where you've got a super duper Amanda Palmer fan who's willing to wait in line to get their book signed for 6 hours. You know, these sort of people that you had to deal with at the book signing. You know, and on the other hand, you've got someone who barely knows me but has heard one shred of, you know, all they know is that she's some terrible singer. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even really know what my music is like or what I've written about, and they just have no information. And then everything in between. But, you know, I don't know. Dylan was like, when I first sat down with Dylan, we were sort of talking about how I would perceive myself and how I define myself and how, what was the question you asked? How I identify.
How you identify as an artist and as a person.
Yeah, and that's, you know, maybe it's lazy, but I just feel like it's not my job to explain what kind of artist I am. Like, I feel like that's everyone else's job or a critic's job or whatever. But you know, I've been very humbled in my career in the last 10 years. I've taken a lot of knocks, but I wouldn't trade any of it. I just feel so much more rounded and, you know, three-dimensional than I did 10 years ago.
And it seems like every step along the way, just from an outsider looking in at your career or artistic evolution, everything has added to the evolution, right? Do you feel that that's...
Yeah, I mean, as it should be with every artist and as it should be with every person. Mm-hmm. If you're not gathering some insight and wisdom from every encounter, interaction, you know, mistake, I mean, I feel like I'm going to walk away from this conversation a little different. Mm-hmm. And I like that about life. I like that I feel like it's a work in progress and it's actually progressing. Mm. And I'm not just getting more unhappy and jaded and bitter.
Totally. Yeah. That's great. That's a great trajectory.
Do you have questions for me about anything in regards to that tweet as well, or anything you've wondered about me that we haven't addressed?
I don't know. I mean, I wonder if... I wonder if just having a conversation with me as a real person, like, has made you think anything about how, you know, I'm sort of interested in the internet in general, how people use it, what people think when they use it. My whole relationship with the internet and how I do things and how I tweet and how I communicate has just been a constant weird work in progress for the past 20 years or whatever. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts or reflections about the internet, how we're on it and how you use it, and if this has given you any insight.
Yeah, this is giving me a lot of insight. Things that I thought I already understood, you know, like, oh, anyone can come across this. Anyone can find it. Your boss can find it. The approach that I've taken over the last couple of years is truly understanding that what I put out there, somebody else could find it, which was this sense I had, this horrifying, like, stomach sinking feeling when I saw Dylan's message initially. It's like, oh no, what did I say? What did I say that's coming back to haunt me? So kind of the approach I started taking was, you know, if my husband found this, would he be proud of me? Would he be like, yes, I support that opinion? Or what is wrong with you? Like, I've lost respect for you. And so hearing it in this sense and hearing the people who read these tweets and who are on the receiving end of it, I think honestly makes me want to be more cautious with how I approach this. With, it could be anybody reading this. It could be a child. It could be the person I'm talking to. And I thought I understood that, but then to face the consequences is very different. I don't know if that sounds really ignorant, it probably is.
No, not at all.
No, it's the opposite. And actually, I have this, it's funny you should mention your husband. I do this thing with Neil. We sort of have a deal with each other. And we do a couple of things. If I see something that Neil has tweeted, or he sees something that I have tweeted that we think veers into the realm of, it's just too inconsiderate, it's just not the right thing, you don't want to put that kind of negative energy out into the universe, we text each other and we say, delete that tweet. Mm. I saw it. It's just not.
I like that.
It's just not a good look on you, honey.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And then very rarely the other partner will defend it and be like, burr, 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 burr.
Yeah.
But okay, you're right. And then, you know, 99% of the time we will delete the tweet. But also we'll send each other text before we tweet it and just be like, do you think this is okay to say? Do you think this is, you know, kind and considerate enough given what's going on? Da, 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 da. And we sort of use each other as editors. And also, you know, even as I'm typing out the text to Neil, I'm just going like, delete, delete, delete. I already know what the right thing to say here is. I already know what's unkind and inconsiderate. I already know what's too passive aggressive. And, you know, we all have that wise, compassionate inner critic that sits on your shoulder and is like, you know that that's not really a nice thing to say, or that it's just not necessary, or that it's just, you know, it's got a little dig in it, or it's got a little barb in it, or you're coming across as kind and compassionate, but you've just got to stick that one thing in there to prove that you're right or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's a really wonderful thing about a marriage or whatever the partnership. Sometimes I use my, you know, different friends of mine as sounding boards for things like that. And, you know, and then it's sort of like we become the collective better angels of our own nature, and we sort of help each other ride those temptations to just fire off the angry tweet or the bitchy tweet or whatever it is. And Neil and I have saved each other's asses a lot doing that.
Well, I think there is.
Yeah, there's this sense that there's no consequences for what you say on the internet. You know, there's no repercussions for it. Say how you feel, whatever it is, when that's still not the reality.
And I don't believe that the answer should be everyone privatizing these sentiments and then going off into private spaces where they express the same things just under lock and key. Do you know what I mean? I think what I'm more interested in doing is doing stuff like this, right? Where it's more just like, okay, you said that. That's great. And now let's turn that into a conversation, right? Turning these kind of negative sentiments into a conversation is, I actually think, the way forward. Otherwise, you're not acknowledging how human psychology works.
Yeah.
If I said that the goal of this project was that everyone now only writes nice things, that is not acknowledging how humans operate. And that's not acknowledging how I operate either, you know?
Right.
But I just think, like, it is beautiful to me when people can own up to something that they've said and then push through that.
Do the work.
Do the work, right. And that's exactly what is happening right now, which I think is really cool.
I think you're doing a beautiful thing, Dylan.
Oh, I think we're all doing a beautiful
thing. Agreed.
This is now a love fest. I really feel like this
You're the internet's relationship therapist.
I'm the internet's relationship therapist. This is how I identify. So
you're the internet mediator.
Yes, I'm Dr. Phil of the digital space. Dr. Phil's not a mediator.
Dr. Filternet.
Dr. Filternet. Okay, that's my new name. Please don't call me Dylan.
Oh, that's good.
Yes, Dr. Filternet. This is me. This is who I am. Hello, world. I'll tell my husband that that's my new name, and he must take it. Anyway, so we're coming to a close of this really beautiful conversation. Individually, I each asked you separately to name your perceptions of the other. And I want to ask that question again. Amanda, what is your perception of Colleen now?
Well, I didn't know very much about Colleen going into this. And, you know, all I had was one terrible tweet, which... I really admire her. I mean, even just from the beginning of this conversation, Colleen, you seem like a very grounded, open person. And, you know, you certainly don't seem like a hateful person to me. And yeah, I mean, I was like, of course, really sort of anxious and frightened going into a conversation like this, because how frightening. But yeah, you strike me as a really beautiful person.
And Colleen, same question for you about Amanda. How do you perceive Amanda now?
Very differently, honestly. And I'm a little embarrassed to say that I view her more human than I did before.
No, that's a great thing.
Before I did see a character. I saw this kind of shock value persona. Whereas now I see a lot based on this conversation. I can empathize with a lot of things. And I see this person who, while they kind of, I guess, I don't know how to word this. In a way, it seems like you tried to present yourself as somebody who doesn't care what other people think, when in reality, I mean, everyone's ultimately going to care to some degree. And I think your ability to push through that and to really present yourself as, while this might be scary and this is what I'm going to do, it's who I am and it's real. And that's what I see right now, is I see someone who is exactly who they are. And that's not very eloquent, but yeah, I see someone who cares very deeply, who is very creative and kind of owns up to whatever has happened. And these are the situations, this is what I've done. And this is where I've been. And I really admire that a lot. I admire somebody who can just say, this is it. Yeah, I was just thinking, because the bookstore is right up the road, and I was like, maybe I should actually go read The Art of Asking.
What if this was just a long ploy to get you to buy Amanda's book?
Yeah. You're also like returning to the scene of the crime where you had your traumatic evening with all my irritating fans.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes.
Colleen.
No, I have a very good perspective on you now, Amanda. Like part of me wants to delete that tweet, but that's erasing what's happened.
Well,
and I don't want to hide, and I don't want to be shameful for it. It is what it is, but I don't hate you.
Oh,
at all, in any regard.
If you will do it offline, but if you give me your address, I'll just send you a copy of the book.
Ooh,
I would love to.
I can transfer that information.
That is so kind of you.
Yeah. Well, this has been such a lovely conversation. Thank you both so much for taking part in this. I think this takes tremendous energy from both parties. So thank you so much.
You're an amazing internet therapist.
Listen, that's how I was licensed by an invisible internet psychology university. Are there any final... Colleen?
I was going to just say thank you to Amanda for doing this. Thank you for having this conversation with me and for being open to it in the first place. Because I was afraid to come into this. I've been mildly shaking all day.
I was afraid. Yeah.
I was afraid to own up to what I had done and to say to someone, I said a really terrible thing about you and let's talk about it. Thank you for having this conversation and for listening to me and for hearing me out. And for just, for being here, really, thank you. And same to you, Dylan. Like, thank you for starting this. Like, this is...
Oh my God, of course. I love doing this.
I love your podcast. I love this concept. I love who you are. This has been so great.
Thank you, Colleen.
And you too, thank you for taking the time out of your day to do this. And it takes a lot of integrity to come into a conversation like this. And I'm really grateful that you did.
Yeah, me too. Well, Colleen, I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll all just be our own little separate humans going about our place in the world.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. This has been great.
Thanks, bye. Colleen. Bye.
All right. Have a great day. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to be a guest on this show, please visit www.conversationswithpeoplewhohateme.com for more information. Conversations with People Who Hate Me is a production of Night Vale Presents. Vincent Cascione is the sound engineer and mixer. Christy Gressman is the executive producer. The theme song is These Dark Times by Caged Animals. The brand new logo was designed by Philip Blackowl with a photo by Mindy Tucker. And this podcast was created, produced, and hosted by me, Dylan Marin. Special thanks to Adam Cecil and our publicist, Megan Larson. For this episode, I'd like to send out an extra special thank you to Haley Rosenblum, Michael McComiskey, Fanny Cohen, Jordan Verzar, and all of Amanda's team for their help on this conversation. We'll be releasing episodes every other week, so I will see you in 2 weeks with a brand new conversation. Until then, remember, there's a human on the other side of the screen.
Racing through these dark times, and it's hard to take it, but we're gonna make it through these dark times, make it through these dark times, make it through these dark times.